That was a special segment by DJ Alita for Radio Autonomía that she did a few years ago. Radio Autonomía had this special segment with the Biblioteca Popular Víctor Martínez, and the biblioteca is still open. And today in the studio we have Omar from the biblioteca here with us. Can you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what brought you to the biblioteca and your general experience thus far?
Okay. My name's Omar. I was one of the original people involved in the biblioteca on the first day. And the way it came about was I had been involved in the takeover of the Lakeview School, which was a occupation and sit-in to stop the closure of that school, which is located across the street from the Grand Lake Theater. And that lasted 3 weeks. We had a lot of, we saw a lot of interesting possibilities in the process of taking over, first of all, a historic, beautiful building, and then a building that was supposed to be used, like a school is a community center. It is a place that draws people in all over the community. It focuses on positive things, on education, and on keeping a neighborhood strong. And people really liked the idea of doing political work in such an environment. And the space was really cool. And so there was a free school there. And then at night we were having events. And it was a real great aggregator and a wonderful experience. Of course, like everything, the police came and, you know, busted it up. About 3 weeks into it. After that, we wanted to, a lot of the people who, or some of the people who were involved in that, wanted to do a follow-up to catch some of that energy. And we started talking about, you know, empty buildings owned by the OUSD throughout the city, especially in this time where they were closing five schools, right? And in the preparation for that, we wanted to do like a spectacle action, for lack of a better word, where we would like open up a building and show the possibilities to a community of taking over space and taking over buildings that have been closed to fight the disinvestment and the austerity that's affecting some of our poor people of color communities in Oakland and everywhere throughout this country. So we had very modest goals, right? So we wanted to get the building open. We had about, I think, 400 books. We had a whole process of how we were going to get the building open, clean it up, get the books on the shelves, and be out of there before the police could arrest us, right? So we were very excited about getting that done. And then as we were kind of still there, kind of, you know, cleaning up a little bit more and checking out the building, and it was kind of neat and exciting, people just started coming up. People just started coming out of the community, looking inside the building, people who had lived there their whole lives, some people who had gone to it when it was a library. It was a library for 60 years, from 1918 to the mid-70s, and then it was the Emiliano Zapata Street Academy, which also had a lot of significance for people there because it saved a lot of young people in that community because it was a Chicano-run alternative school at a time when there wasn't a lot of stuff like that. And, you know, so it had a lot of fond remembrances for people in the neighborhood. People came up and said, I went to school there. Women in their 50s and 60s who were like, you know, I went to that library when I was a little kid. It was the first library I ever went to. So it just started, you know, people were like wheeling in books. Cars were showing up. Kids were bringing books, kids' books that they had that they didn't need anymore, right? Oh, I know, right? And so it was just like, well, we can't walk away, right? I mean, we got something here, and very quickly it wasn't our project anymore. I mean, we started out with a core group of maybe four people, and very quickly it became a project encompassing about 30 people. About 10 of those people were kids, and very committed kids, and that's what really made me excited, is that these kids didn't need a lot of direction, and they didn't need to be explained why it was a good thing, especially it was the summer. And these kids had nowhere to go except the corner liquor store and hang out. And so, and they'd seen that closed off space, the grounds and the building, for a long time, and wonder what was up with that. So very early on, the kids went into the back part of the grounds, and they took some spare wood that we found on the corner, and they started building the first beds for the garden. They didn't get anything planted, but we had, on the first day, at the end of the day, we had three boxes ready to get soil in them and to plant stuff. And that was almost all the kids. And a couple of other people who knew their way around the stuff, but didn't really, they weren't really directing anything. So, so that was really amazing. And then, you know, we met people all day long, and it was just wow. And then at the end of the day, someone got the idea, I can't even remember who, to have a potluck and spoken word. The spoken word would be on the steps of the library. And that was just an amazing, beautiful experience without electricity. So we did it in the dark and with candles and with lanterns. And people talked, you know, one guy talked about his experience in having gone to jail. One of the people you heard on the intro, he talked about she was like a self-educated historian of Oakland who has this like vast command of the history of specifically that neighborhood in Jingletown. And he gave a little talk about the school, the Emiliano Zapata Street Academy, and the neighborhood itself, and some Chicano history from the community. People got up and did spoken word. People laughing, talking. The whole street was just, I'm getting a little choked up actually talking about it, but it was just really an amazing experience. And then, you know, by the end of the day, the cops came. They shut down the entire neighborhood for a four-block radius, right? Four-block square radius, I guess what I want to say. 2 blocks in every direction. They were real dicks about it. I mean, we wouldn't let anyone come into the neighborhood, their own neighborhood. People who lived in the community had to stand outside while they threw out the only decent thing that had happened in that lot and in that building for a really long time, for like 10 years, 10 to 15 years. You know, we rescued some of the books. They gave us a chance to get the books out, and then they shut it down, and then they put a piece of plywood over the door in a really silly gesture. And we were a little devastated because we had started out without having a lot of hopes. But beyond that, it was no longer an issue of not having a lot of expectations. It was seeing the potentials. The vast potential of communities coming together and not run by activists, and that was what was great about it. It was just an expression of mutual solidarity, work, fun, people saying, you know, the Occupy movement passed us by. It never came out here. You know, there was a lot of critique about Occupy, and that was one you didn't hear very often because a lot of the critique was that it was kind of like all white and blah, blah, blah. But I think a lot of people were like, well, we're out here and we want to do stuff. We can't go downtown. We need stuff to happen in our community. And they weren't exactly sure how to make that happen. So now this thing was kind of getting ready to go, and people were excited about being included in this historical political moment. And so it was a little crushing. So the next day we came back, and tell me if I'm going too long. I can actually talk about this for a really long time. So the next day we came back, and we had all the books, and different people had taken the books home to save them. And that was another thing, is like throughout the day, we started out about 300 books. But by the end of the day, we had like 1,000 or over 1,000 books, donated books and milk crates. And that's how we had them all in milk crates and donated boxes and stuff like that. So we decided just to show that we had been there and we had taken this space, and that you can't just destroy this with brute force, right? We are at least going to be here for a little while, as a comment against, you know, like speak out against that. And instantly, people still were really cool. People still were really into that. People were still really excited about it. And so we had, and this was during a period, I think, and it's hard, difficult for me to remember, but I think the library was going through a mandatory closure period. I don't know if I'm conflating with that with something else. That certainly happened in Washington State. There was a mandatory closure period for the library because they ran out of money. And we inspired, this whole action inspired a sidewalk occupation library that happened there against budget cuts, I think it was called. And so we stayed out there for, I think, about a month. We were out there 24/7. It was a 24/7 occupation, books, conversation. People would come in and out. People would stay with us. People would have a read-in with us. There's some great photos of like, you know, 15 people in a row sitting on a couch that we found on the street reading books all at the same time, which just looked really wonderful. And then we eventually, the police gave us a little bit of a hard time. They harassed us quite a bit during that period. And we decided that we needed to up the ante. And so a few of us who could take the risk went into the grounds, which were also fenced off, and started the garden. So it was like a garden under siege that we started. And then the kids kind of, they did what they wanted. I mean, we never encouraged kids to do it because we didn't want to take that role of, like, you know, inciting kids to crawl under the fence. But they did it anyway. We couldn't stop them. And so they were the first people. We also had a garden outside along the perimeter. And then we just brought stuff in and started the garden inside. And from there, it grew. And so we moved the library inside, and we opened the gate up. And ever since then, it's been the struggle of keeping the original concept going and making it as inclusive and as horizontal as possible, and eventually being able to, as activists, walk away completely, leaving a center for community power that's run by the community and that as activists we can visit fondly and remember that we were lucky enough, you know, to have a role in it.
That kind of brings us to a question about essentially logistics, right? So, like, I mean, what you bring up is this problem of what do you need to happen, or what needs to happen for this space to continue to function? And what does, you know, what does it look like to have a public space or a public project or a community project that people sort of participate in, and then the folks who, you know, who you call the activist folks can sort of step back, right? Like, what does that even look like, and what kinds of things are required for that to happen? Infrastructure, people, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and one that because there's not a lot of role models here, so or guidelines. So it's a question we've asked ourselves quite a bit, and it's a lot harder to run a public occupation that's not welcomed by the city. We got kicked out once, and then there was a question of how we were going to deal with that. So kicked off the grounds a little later. So the question of the logistics question is a pretty brutal question. I mean, you have this space that has traditionally in the community been closed with lots of holes in the fence and lots of ways to get in for people who are down to do certain things. And we don't judge people or anything, but a lot of those things aren't healthy for the community. You know, there's a lot of underage prostitution in the area. It's a very complex issue. And some of that was happening there before we came. And there's a lot of kind of toxic drug use and alcohol abuse that's not good for anybody that was going on there as well. So we wanted to maintain a safe space, so we had to have the gate locked. For example, this is a logistic issue that's really been difficult. We had to have the gate locked and open, right? Someone had to lock the gate and someone had to open it, and it had to feel like it wasn't the boss coming in, it wasn't the leader coming in to open the gate or close it, that anyone could have that opportunity with a little bit of like control about who would be able to do that. So even such things as like, are we going to have a key lock or a combination lock? Some people, we realize, don't even know how to use a combination lock. I mean, they don't know about that part where the combination has to go twice around, right? And so explaining why that even had to happen, that was like a workshop. Do you know what I mean? So some of it was like the pure logistics of making something accessible. And that's been kind of a challenge. And also interesting, some of that is fun, you know, to figure out how to make something like that accessible. And we finally figured out a way to do it that's very accessible, very open. And a lot of people have access to the space. A lot of people can open it on their own and be in there. People leave it open so that other people can use it. And then on Sundays, we also have like a day where we invite as many people who are involved as possible to be out there and hanging out. so that new people who want to come in have a way of connecting with us, because we're not that easy to find, and most people, a lot of people in that community aren't, you know, either tech savvy or they're not on the internet, so they're not going to find us the other way. So we have to make physical eye-to-eye contact to bring new people in. I don't know if there's a, I mean, also, I can keep going, but like, I mean, it's interesting because so, and this is, you know, what's great about the logistics issue is that it gives us an opportunity to get people involved in the community in a way that's fun, problem solving, and that creates new capacities, especially for younger people. So we've had an issue with water because we don't have any running water in the space. So how to get water to water our crops has been an issue from the beginning, and it's one that the neighbors have solved with us. And then recently we decided we would build a rain collection system, and we built that along with several neighbors who lent their expertise to do it with found objects in the space. How do we keep the books dry? I mean, you know, we have them in milk crates in the summer, but that's not going to work. So for the winter, although this winter it could have possibly worked for a really long time. But you know, we, with two or three members of the community, we gathered up all the scrap wood in the space, and from the scrap wood, we made a structure based on how much wood we had, which was very challenging and a lot of fun, and we knocked it out mostly in a day, and we took corrugated metal from the fence line and cut that in half with the help of another community member who had some tools. And we made the roof, and that thing's still there. It's covering, it shelters the books. It also allows people to go in and sit down. You know, it's a very small space, but you can sit down there and read a book if it's raining, for example. So, so yeah, all the logistics issue is, has been challenging enough in a nightmare. And it's also been this great way of aggregating people to the project in a way that's challenging and fun and exciting. So,
Well, gentrification is a real issue that people in Oakland are and have been grappling with for a long time, and especially this current wave of the tech boom. A lot of folks are talking about how West Oakland is becoming more gentrified, and I know that the Biblioteca is located in East Oakland, so I'm wondering, what's the Biblioteca's approach to gentrification in Oakland?
It's a very good question. So this is an area in the San Antonio district that's not currently, at the flatlands part, being gentrified in any significant way. But you do get the sense that it's creeping in. We're not very far from a lot of freeway entrances, very close to the bridge. We're not very far from Fruitvale BART. We're pretty close to East Lake and downtown. So this is definitely a part of East Oakland. I wouldn't call it East Oakland, the San Antonio district. Definitely a part that's open for gentrification, and I'm just wondering when it's going to start happening. So one of the issues, especially with community gardens, and I think an organization, I don't want to say their name, but only because I don't want to cast any negative light on them, because I think they're great. When that area of North Oakland was being gentrified, the realtors who were doing a lot of the, you know, marketing were using them and their community garden that they had worked really hard with members of the community as an anti-gentrification tool. They were using that as an attractor for gentrifiers. And that's very disturbing. And they had to put out a very detailed response to that to say, no, screw that. You're not going to use us to gentrify. That's the whole point, is to give fresh food in a food desert and to get people in the community out there taking care of space that's been forgotten by the city, you know, and community empowerment, and to have it used that way. So definitely community gardens are this double-edged sword. If you do it, if you're doing it right, you can create a community aggregator. You can teach people about agriculture. You can teach people how to do certain skills. You can share skills people have. And create a little node of power where people can at least get to know one another. I mean, at Biblioteca Popular, the idea is that should a political movement be occurring, this could be a place potentially where people could come and talk about how to plug into it and help one another. And it can also be a place where people can share ideas of how to make money, how to survive. I have work. Do you need work? I'm a metal worker. I do this. Why don't we see if together, when I get work and they need a metal worker, we can go in as a team? You know, that kind of thing. And we also have a community free box that we put up on the fence. That's completely autonomous. We don't do anything with that. And people put stuff in when they don't need it, and people take stuff out when they need it. And it's been really nice to see that, see what ends up in there, and to see the people really thinking about each other in this one space and running this thing. And we also have a food distribution along with Food Not Bombs kind of gives us some food that's packaged food that's expired and no longer legally saleable, but still good to eat. And so we've been bringing that in. And I got off a tangent. But in terms of gentrification, we're very aware that a community garden can look very attractive to realtors and to people who want to come into a community but are afraid of black people and are afraid of brown people. And so one of the things we've done to fight that potential misuse of the concept is to really strongly ask people who aren't from the community to not get involved at that level, to support, to donate, to talk about, and maybe even help others start, but not to come there and want to do a yoga class or not. And I'm not saying it like that, but, you know, because we would do a yoga class. In fact, I mean, one great thing that's happened is that a neighbor started a Qigong class, and he's a guy who's been through some really tough times and learned this process where he can find some inner peace. And he wanted to share that because he was going through a very difficult time in his life that really sucks, but I don't want to go too much into it. But he wanted to share that as a way of basically keeping sane, right? And we had the space where he could do that. And so you have this guy who had never been able to share that anywhere coming into this space and being able to share that. That was a point where we were like, okay, it's okay for people from outside of the community to come maybe, so that he has definitely each time he's going to have people to teach to. But also people from, you know, inside the community came, and they're basically Qigong is Tai Chi, and so the people are learning about Tai Chi and martial arts. And he had a very lovely way of talking about it. And so basically, yeah, I just want to get back to that. So, you know, it could very well be a tool for gentrification, and we're very aware of that. It can be a very powerful tool against gentrification if that community faces that challenge, and we want to create the potential and platform where if neighbors are facing that kind of thing, which could very well happen, they have a place to unite. They have a public space to say, to come up with something, and I think that's something that's very absent in places that have been gentrified because they've been so disinvested by the city and the state that people feel isolated. They're in their apartments and in their homes, and they're experiencing all these things by themselves of being priced out of their neighborhoods, and they don't have a way to come together and aggregate their experiences. So hopefully, and it's up to people from the community, obviously, that can be an anti-gentrification tool. So, and there's something also that we hope that people take that example, because the disinvestment that led to the Miller Library being closed is the first step necessary to create the process of gentrification. You have to have a very disinvested area and neighborhood, and places like the Miller Library are very symbolic of it, and that's one of the reasons we chose it in the first place.
I think there's an interesting sort of question. You've been talking a lot about public space and community space and the different kinds of space that are involved in this library occupation. So like there's, you know, the space outside of the fence, then there's a fence, and then there's space inside of the fence, and then there's a building, there's walls, right? And then there's a plywood, you know, plywood over the door or whatever. And then there's an inside the building kind of space. And so I wonder, like, you know, how important is space for the occupation? How important is it? You know, why is it so much more important to be inside the fence than outside the fence? And why not be inside the building instead of outside the building? You know what I mean? It's kind of like one of these, like, what, how is the space configured in a particular way by these boundaries that makes it open and closed, but not too closed and not too open? You know what I mean? At the same time. It's kind of...
I'm not sure I know what you mean, but I'll try. And you tell me if I'm hitting it, right? So, I mean, the city had the space closed. And I think that's the most important thing to remember. Is just like, you have this building. We can't get into the building right now. And the reason we're not going to go into the building is that because immediately 80 cops would be there to kick us out. So that's one. That's kind of a red line we can't cross yet. And that's something we would like to eventually... create a situation where if people really want that building for a community center, and it's a wonderful building, they have a process where they can start building strength for that. It hasn't happened yet, but everyone wants it. It's a question of them needing to do some basic work for it and us standing back and letting that work happen without directing it. But the city had the space closed, right? And so it was the city preventing people from being in this building full time. The only reason to take a risk of going in the building or going on the grounds was to do stuff that was riskier to do outside. And a lot of that stuff has been a real burden for this community in terms of chemical and substance abuse and dependency. It's still a big challenge for us dealing with that in this neighborhood. Some very tragic stories. And so opening up the space is like saying, well, now everyone can use this space. You're not just limiting the space to people who feel like they have nothing to lose and are going to use it for things that can be toxic to the community. That could still happen, right? And we're not going to judge people. And in fact, who are those people I'm talking about, have contributed great stuff to the library anyway. I mean, they've come out there and they've been positive, even when they're high or even when they're in a bad way. They've created positive energy. You know, one guy who was there, you know, brought us a lot of books. He was a big reader. He suggested, you know, what a lot of homeless people like reading. And so, you know, like adventure books and spy novels and stuff like that. He had the names, and that was cool. And but now, so opening up, giving people access to what's inside the fence opens up the possibilities of what you can do with that space, and really empowers everyone in the community to make it something that reflects people's aspirations and their desires. And I think, you know, one of the things people would like is to have something. If you ever saw this place before, it's covered in garbage, mattresses, needles, pipes, you know, and now it doesn't reflect that. And so when families walk by it, it feels a little better. It feels like, you know, maybe we matter, you know, maybe we don't live in a garbage dump, you know. And so that process of taking over the interior has also reflected on the outside of it. And people who never walk into the space at all walk by it and smile and go, well, that's really cool that they're doing this. I feel a little better about my, you know, walk home. So I don't know if I answered it at all.
So you started talking a little bit about this already, but I'm wondering if you can, well, this is kind of a three-part question, if you can talk a little bit about the decision-making process that you all take as this entity of Biblioteca Popular, and if the community is part of that entity, or if there's a larger, if there's another kind of circle of decision making that happens at the community level, and then also if there is this kind of desire of incorporating the community's rich history of struggle, how is that incorporated? And I can ask the last question after.
Decision making has been a challenge. Right at the beginning, we had some really great meetings about how to approach the space. We filled the whole sidewalk with families, and it was fun, and we had, you know, translation, and people felt very empowered. And As time has gone on, it's hard for families who are working really hard. It's not only working really hard, it's the day-to-day grind, and it's, you know, people don't feel good about themselves for a week at a time, 2 weeks at a time, and they're in a funk because the situation in that community sucks. And so does the work situation of people who can live in such a community. So throughout this period, we've had a lot of bottomliners coming out of the community, and we've had, you know, the pleasure of working with some homegrown geniuses, basically, you know, a guy who lives down the street, and all these people having lived in the community for a really long time. And it goes back to the gentrification question. These are people who have invested their lives in the community, and they are the main ones who've come out to be the bottom liners, and that's very cool. So, you know, right at the beginning, we had a couple of people, especially one guy who was very down, who lived down the street, who was part of the main decision-making process, and he was making things happen. And then, you know, for different reasons, he had to phase out. And then someone else came in and filled a lot of that role along with other people that he brought in. And then he phased out for a little while and came back in. So what I'm saying is that it's been a revolving place, and that's definitely been the challenge, is how, and I think any activist has gone through this experience anyway, of how do you keep a core group of motivated people who are going to make the thing keep running. And we've been lucky in that we never go too long without finding those people to come back, but that we always feel like it's not quite getting to the point where you have a committed group. And the question is it even possible? And maybe actually, is it even desirable? I mean, maybe this is the way. But also a lot of things happen with no decision making at all, and which is awesome too. And that could definitely work out. I mean, if we pull back all the way and just let things happen, it's quite possible that people on their own would come in and do what needs to be done, or if they didn't, that they would see that it fell down and that they would reconstruct. And so that's the point we're at right now, where we're letting that process happen, and maybe people can cohere into their own group, because I feel as I'm a Latino and I speak Spanish and I have a lot of friendships in the community, but I also feel like at a certain point, because I look like a leader, not that I look like a leader, but that I come off as the leader because I've been involved so long, people actually get disempowered by that. And there's nothing I can do at this point to remove that impression, right? And so, like, one of the things I have to do is really scale back and allow people to come in, fail, make mistakes, blow it off, you know, all those things that are very scary for someone who's invested a lot of time in a project, but that have to happen. And so that's been my sort of my personal struggle. And it's also created a situation where you come into the place and someone's planted a couple peach trees and you don't know who, and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And they're green, and so that they're being watered. And so, you know, or there's a bunch of books there, or there's someone brought us a nice chair, or, you know, other things have happened in the space that show that people are investing their time and attention, and gives me the feeling, us the feeling, that we can start pulling back, and that power is going to be there. But it's, you know, standing on the precipice and just letting go. So I don't know if I answered the whole question for you.
Well, I guess the second part of that question, and I can say the other question as well, is if there's a desire and or has the Biblioteca Popular already been incorporating the community's rich history of struggle? And then the second question is, what are the forms that the Biblioteca is supporting the community's expression of liberation?
So the community... The community is diverse. It's mostly Latino, but it's also, there are a lot of African-American people there historically, also Latino people historically, and Asian and South Asian people historically. So the community has a very diverse, rich history of struggle, and people being in this community, a lot of people being in this community for various reasons and from various time periods, as a struggle, as part of that struggle, African American community coming to for jobs from more racist parts of the country, South Asian people fleeing U.S. sponsored imperialism and bad things in their own place, and Latino people escaping the poverty created by imperialism and capitalism. Right. So, obviously, that's all there, and keeping a space that's not too heavily centered in any one direction, so that anyone can come in and feel part of it, has been one of the things that we've been trying to do. During the prison hunger strike, we are right across the street from a parole halfway house, and we've been very honored to have two people from that going through that process of getting on their feet, finding work, and they're staying in this halfway house during this period, come and want to become a part of the community in a really strong way and do that. I see that as a struggle for them, as like a, you know, as almost revolutionary for them to do that, because it's illegal, right? And these people are on parole. So I don't know why I'm whispering, but I don't know if I should be saying all this. I don't want to get anyone in trouble. But so that, to me, that's incredible, right? And you have people who are undocumented, bringing their undocumented children into the space, and it's technically illegal. And they know it. You know, we warn people. We want everyone to know. You're breaking the law when you come in here. You're trespassing, right? And they're like, screw it. You know, we want this place to run. We want to have a place that's meaningful. And this place was garbage before. The city can't do it. We're going to do it. And that has been really powerful to watch people take those kinds of risks to make this place work. And I mean, other than that, we let people come in and view it in any way they want. So we're not pushing any particular line. Or I think that's one thing, important thing to say, is that we don't beat people over the head with politics, and we listen to how people view it politically. So.
So we're kind of running out of time here, and so we just wanted to kind of conclude maybe by asking if there's anything else that you'd like to share before, you know, going, and maybe also talking about if folks are interested in learning more about the Biblioteca Popular, or maybe coming down and checking it out or getting involved, if that's possible, you know, where would they be able to find out information about that?
So, as I said before, we invite people to come and take a look and to have a coffee with us on Sundays, but not too many people. So Sundays from 11 to about 2 or 3, we're out there. On days where there's a lot of work to do, we do the work. We call it a work day, but if on a day there's not a lot of work to do, we drink coffee and hang out. So people can come, take a look, and visit us then. And on Facebook, we are Biblioteca Popular Victor Martinez. And on Twitter, we are Biblioteca Popul. It's B-I-B, because we ran out of room on the Twitter account. So that's B-I-B-L-I-O-T-E-C-A-P-O-P-U-L. And that's basically the ways to contact us. And so we're definitely there on Sundays. If people want to come by, ask about it, learn more about it, or donate some books, definitely donating books, gardening materials, soil, compost. And we would love another water barrel. So if someone out there has a water barrel, that'd be really cool. So Sundays from 11 to 2, we're out there. I don't know if I answered everything.
And we'll have those links up on our website for folks to connect. And, yeah, thank you so much for being here with us and sharing a little bit more about giving us an update about what's been going on with the Biblioteca Popular Victor Martinez.
Thank you.